This episode features discussion of kidnapping and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
March 15th, 1985. 50-year-old Father Lawrence Martin Janko was taped like a mummy in a car trunk somewhere in Lebanon. He had been held captive for 2 months, and already his guards were moving him to his third prison.
The Catholic priest lay in darkness. His head throbbed from a beating he'd suffered just hours before. He could hear the men joking in Arabic outside. Then one of them opened the trunk.
Through the loose weave of his blindfold, Father Janko could see their unsympathetic faces, the machine guns strapped to their backs. He waited for them to lift his body out of the trunk. Instead, the guards reached in, their palms filled with a strange putty, and smeared the goop all over his body. One of the men joked in broken English how easy it would be to blow him up from the trunk of the car.
The putty was explosive, but with his limbs taped together, Father Janko was helpless. Then the guards began to laugh. They said the explosive was a dud, just a prank.
Father Janko's life was a joke to them, and his death would surely be the punchline. This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help.
This is our final episode on Father Lawrence Martin Janko, a Catholic priest taken hostage by a Lebanese terrorist organization. Last week, we examined the curious mix-up that led to Father Janko's capture. We also followed the trajectory of the Lebanese terrorist organization Hezbollah and their extremist co-founder, Ahmad Mughnia.
This week, we'll delve into the wretched living conditions and abuse Father Janko experienced in captivity. We'll also follow his family's campaign for his release and the multiple efforts to free Father Janko and other U.S. hostages in Lebanon. Late January 1985, 50-year-old Father Janko was chained to a radiator in the dirty kitchen of an apartment overlooking Lebanon's Baca Valley. On his lap lay an abridged version of David Copperfield that one of his guards had given him. He must have read it 10 times already, with the glasses he'd had in his pocket when he was captured. Reaching beneath his sweater, he pulled out a raw potato and nibbled off a piece. He placed it near the small hole where his friends, a family of ants, were busy foraging.
Father Janko envied their freedom. He had been in this filthy kitchen for nearly a month, and he still didn't know why. Nevertheless, he had adapted to a little routine. Meals were 3 times a day. Lebanese bread, rice, fava beans, and the occasional vegetable. He was also given 1 daily trip to the toilet.
For a while, this visit to the bathroom included a hot shower. Then the boiler in the basement exploded. It had been weeks since he had felt even remotely clean or warm. The radiator he was chained to didn't work, and at night, his guards had to pile blankets on top of him to keep him from freezing.
And he was still experiencing occasional tightness around his heart. The day before his capture, Father Janko had visited a doctor for tests. He tried not to dwell on what the result might have been, especially since his father had died at age 53 from a heart attack.
His two guards provided occasional distractions during the long days. They were gentle towards Father Janko, calling him Abuna, the Arabic word for our father. If he was lucky, they would strike up a small conversation in broken English.
One guard told a story of his sister visiting a restaurant in Switzerland. Not knowing a common word for chicken, she had to act it out. The guard burst into laughter, and Father Janko couldn't help but chuckle too.
One of the men occasionally brought Father Janko a small bag of cookies from his wife. The other gave him Muslim prayer beads to add to the Catholic rosary he'd made out of potato sack strings.
These small relationships brought a mild sense of comfort to Father Janko during his seemingly endless days, but he was otherwise alone. Most of the long, quiet hours were passed by praying with his rosary, although he had other, more devious ways of passing the time.
Every so often, soldiers would bring fresh food like mutton, potatoes, and tomatoes to the apartment. Father Janko found chances to sneak pieces of food off the kitchen counter. He would hide them in his clothes to snack on between meals or to share with the family of aunts.
One afternoon in February, Father Janko spied a jeep coming over the hill. He grabbed the sweater he used as a blindfold. A car meant visitors, and he was expected to wear a blindfold anytime someone new entered the apartment.
A few minutes later, a strange man strode into the kitchen. Through the loose weave of his blindfold, Father Janko could detect his dark eyebrows, a bushy beard, and a strong frame.
Unbeknownst to him, this was the very man who had ordered his kidnapping.
The stranger crouched in front of Father Janko and began to speak. An interpreter behind him said, "My name is Hadj Radwan."
The conversation was brief. Hadj Radwan did not explain why Father Janko had been kidnapped. He simply told him that he would be going home soon.
Father Janko would hear that word many times over the next 18 months. He would eventually come to mistrust it, but for now, he clung to this scrap of hope.
It would be many years before he or anyone outside of Hezbollah would realize that Hadj Radwan was a pseudonym. The man standing before Father Janko was Imad Mughniyeh, the founder of Hezbollah.
Hezbollah was a Lebanese Shia extremist group funded by Shia revolutionaries in Iran. The group took root in the months following Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Their main goal was to drive Israel and its Western allies out of Lebanon and to establish a pro-Islamic government in the capital city of Beirut.
At the time of Father Janko's kidnapping, Hezbollah was still an underground militia who outwardly called themselves Islamic Jihad, which means holy war.
In December of 1983, Imad Mughniyeh had helped orchestrate the Hezbollah bombing of six locations in Kuwait City, including the U.S. Embassy. In the aftermath, 17 Shia radicals were captured by the Kuwaiti government. One of them was Imad's best friend and brother-in-law, Mustafa Badreddin. In retaliation for Mustafa's capture, Imad had ordered the kidnapping of several U.S. citizens in Beirut. He hoped that President Ronald Reagan would pressure the Kuwaiti government to release their 17 prisoners.
But the Reagan administration, at least at that point, had a staunch policy against negotiating with terrorists. To do so would only incite more acts of terrorism.
In the midst of this impasse, Father Janko had been abducted. His was the fifth of eight American kidnappings connected to Hezbollah, although one prisoner, Jerry Levin, would escape on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1985. That morning, Father Janko's guards burst into his room, panicked. They ordered him to put on his blindfold as they unfastened his chains. In his haste, Father Janko didn't think to grab his glasses or his rosary.
They led him down the hall and into another room of the apartment. Through his blindfold, he could see a rope made of bedsheets dangling from a small window high up on the wall. Jerry Levin's exit route.
Then, two strange men marched into the room and brought Father Jenko outside. An escaped captive could compromise their location, so they would have to move Father Jenko quickly. They shoved him into a car trunk and sped off.
When they arrived at their destination, Father Jenko was brought into a small living room with an oil heater in the center. A tall, wiry guard was pacing about, an automatic rifle slung over his shoulder. The guard strode over to Father Jenko and asked him to read from a piece of paper. The words in front of him seemed to swim. He realized that he had left his glasses back in the kitchen. He pleaded with the guard to have someone retrieve them. The man just stomped off, leaving Father Jenko alone.
As the evening wore on, one of the men placed a drink in Father Jenko's hands. Obediently, he drank.
Within minutes, a fog began to settle over him. He had been drugged.
As the world slowly slipped away, Father Jenko caught a comforting glimpse of one of his former guards standing in the room. He could barely keep his head upright as he was led outside and shoved into the back seat of a car. Two men wedged in on either side of him. One of them was his old guard. Slumping onto his shoulder, Father Jenko fell into a deep slumber that lasted until morning.
When he came to, he was inside his second prison, higher in the hills surrounding Bekaa Valley. A strange guard led him to a bedroom, which housed a row of several cardboard cubicles all facing the doorway. Father Jenko was placed in one of the cubicles and shackled, left hand and foot. The chains stretched into the guard's adjacent living quarters. They would be able to see any movement he made.
That first night, Father Jenko found himself longing for the crude comforts of his previous prison. At least there, he'd had walls and a window.
Then, a strange voice to his right whispered, "I'm Ben Weir. Who are you?"
Before he could answer, another voice said, "I'm William Buckley."
They were two of the U.S. hostages that had gone missing the year before. Ben was a 61-year-old Presbyterian reverend, and William Buckley had been the CIA chief in Beirut.
Father Jenko knew that speaking to the other hostages was not allowed. Even whispering in the night was a risk, with the guards in the other room. Other than this quick introduction, Father Jenko's days and nights passed in virtual solitary confinement. He would pray to keep himself busy, or regress to childhood, when this kind of solitary play was common.
In this way, and against all odds, Father Jenko was able to stay sane.
Longtime Harvard psychiatrist Dr. Stuart Grassian notes that people with mature, healthy personalities and an average to high IQ have a higher tolerance for the neurological stress of solitary confinement. At the bottom end of the spectrum, individuals whose interior lives were more tumultuous and fearful had a greater chance of succumbing to long-term psychological damage.
Although Father Jenko had never lived in complete isolation before, his interior life was equipped to combat its stressful effects. He already had a daily spiritual routine, a comprehensive worldview, and profound positive beliefs about his individual identity. With these important anchors, he was better equipped to endure the long, uncertain days ahead.
On February 17th, Haj Radwan paid a visit. He directed Father Jenko and Ben Weir to write two letters each, one to an important religious leader and one to family.
Father Jenko wrote his first letter to Cardinal Joseph Bernardin, the Archbishop of Chicago. Following Radwan's directions, he told Cardinal Joseph that he was being held as ransom for 17 Shia prisoners jailed in Kuwait.
This was the first time he had heard a reason for his kidnapping, and it wasn't good news. He was well aware that the Reagan administration did not barter with terrorists, and his next letter deepened his despair.
In the note to his family, Radwan instructed him to write that he would be hung if a rescue attempt was made. He shuddered as he scrawled the words. Would they really go so far as to execute him?
In spite of Father Jenko's mistreatment, Radwan himself had been surprisingly gentle, even kind. When he came to the apartment, he usually checked on Father Jenko, laying a sympathetic hand on his shoulder. He even brought him the pair of glasses he had left behind. This small act of concern amidst degrading circumstances felt nothing short of touching.
Now, this same man was dictating very real threats. Shaken, Father Jenko placed the letters in an envelope and addressed it to his sister, May Mihalik in Joliet, Illinois. He prayed it would arrive before Hadj Radwan's patience ran out.
In a moment, Father Jenko's captors grow frustrated and abusive.
And now, back to our story.
On January 8, 1985, Father Lawrence Martin Jenko was kidnapped by Islamic extremists in Beirut. 6 weeks later, the priest was imprisoned high in the hills overlooking Lebanon's Baqa Valley, hoping that the letter he had written to his sister, May Mihalik, would arrive soon.
Before that letter could arrive, news about the kidnapping broke in the U.S. Investigators in Beirut immediately linked his disappearance to Hezbollah, who had claimed responsibility for four other kidnappings the year before.
That was how the Jenko family learned of their brother's kidnapping, the January 8th morning news. Immediately, they met at the home of Father Jenko's sister, May Mihalik, to organize a plan of action and await the report from Washington.
The news that trickled down from Capitol Hill was discouraging. The Reagan administration had reiterated their stance on foreign hostages. They refused to make deals with terrorists. The Jenko family worried that this standstill could go on for months. Two of the U.S. captives had already been held for nearly a year. And besides having no idea how Father Jenko was being treated, a press report disclosed that he was in poor health. The test results from his recent doctor's appointment confirmed that he had high blood pressure and needed medication.
Distraught, the Jenko family continued to reach out to the White House. They were met with silence.
But behind closed doors, the Reagan administration knew time was pressing in. As with any presidency, swift and effective problem solving was crucial to Reagan's public perception and ultimately his legacy.
But with hostage negotiations off the table, little could be done. Even a raid was impossible without knowing precisely where in Lebanon the hostages were being held.
In the meantime, the administration sought to manage public perception by minimizing the attention they gave to the hostages. To grant a meeting to their families would create a publicity buzz, adding stress to an already harrowing dilemma. The only course of action was to continue putting pressure on investigators in Beirut. They hoped to at least find a lead on Hezbollah's whereabouts.
When Father Jenko's letters arrived in May's mailbox on March 1st, almost 2 months after the family first heard the news, they were already forming a more sophisticated response. Reaching out to the White House had gotten them nowhere. They'd have to take matters into their own hands.
There were 55 Jenko relatives around their hometown of Joliet, Illinois. Each Monday night, they met at May's house to strategize. They divided the 50 states between the family members and began the enormous task of making their voice heard on the news and reaching every member of Congress. Over the 18 months of their brother's captivity, they would schedule press interviews in almost every state.
Over time, they would secure the support of various congressmen, especially George O'Brien of Will County, Illinois, and Robert Dornan of Orange County, California. Every day, these two men would enter the hostage names on the congressional record as a reminder of the unsolved problem in Lebanon.
Eventually, Ben Weir's wife went public with a letter she received in March. So the Jenko family did the same. They didn't realize this was exactly what Hadj Radwan had wanted.
A key goal of terrorists is to captivate the attention of foreign press. First and foremost, press generates a public response, usually emotional, that forces leaders into quicker action. This improves the terrorists' chances of having their demands met. But Dr. Thomas Strenz, a professional hostage negotiator, notes that while most hostage takers want good press in order to guarantee their safety, terrorist hostage takers have a different concern. Their primary motive is to bring attention to their cause. Sometimes it's their only motive.
In addition to his official demand, the release of the Shia captives in Kuwait, Haj Radwan wanted to bring international awareness to Hezbollah's list of grievances. Giving press to the terrorists was a form of meeting their demands.
However, while the release of Father Jenko's letter caused a small press sensation, it wasn't nearly as much as either Hezbollah or the Jenko family would have desired, which could have been why, on March 15th, Father Jenko was escorted from his cardboard cubicle into an adjacent room. Through his blindfold, he could see one of the guards holding a reel of tape.
His mind raced as he remembered the last time they had taped him from head to toe, like a mummy. He had hardly been able to breathe.
Then, one of the guards took a cloth and held it underneath the blindfold, clearly wanting Father Jenko to open his mouth. Self-preservation overwhelmed him. He said, "I cannot breathe when you do that."
Before he could see what was happening, a fist pounded against his left temple, sending him staggering. Then another hand punched the other side of his head.
Father Jenko held up his hands and obediently opened his mouth. The guard stuffed in the cloth and proceeded to tape him from his ankles to his neck.
They carried him outside, placed him in the trunk of a car, and slammed it shut. A few minutes passed, and the trunk opened again.
A hand reached under Father Jenko's blindfold and pulled the cloth out of his mouth. He was sure it was one of his original guards from the kitchen prison, showing him one final shred of mercy.
After another bumpy, hot car ride, the strange men opened the trunk. But instead of lifting him out, they reached in. Through his sweater blindfold, he could see their hands were filled with a strange putty.
Laughing, the men began to smear the putty all over Father Jenko's body. Then he heard one of them joke about how easy it would be to blow him up if he made any trouble.
Father Jenko's heart pounded. The putty was an explosive. Was this how his ordeal was going to end?
But the nausea quickly gave way to rage as one of the guards laughed that it was a dud. They had just done this to get a rise out of him.
Powerless but seething, Father Jenko was carried up flights of stairs to an apartment, his third prison in as many months. From the sounds of nearby planes, he could tell he was in South Beirut near the airport. He didn't know, though, that the worst part of his captivity had just begun.
This third prison, where he would stay from March until the end of April 1985, was a 3-by-6-foot closet. His guards dressed him from head to toe in a warm jogging suit, making the already stuffy closet unbearably hot.
Every day, he would lay alone in the closet, utterly miserable and pouring sweat. Body odor became a problem, and it irritated his guards to no end. From time to time, they would open the closet door and spray Father Jenko with a can of deodorizer.
He was still experiencing intermittent chest pain, and over the rest of his captivity, his hands and feet would grow more and more numb.
He was also forced to wear his blindfold day and night. He developed an eye infection which oozed continually.
In these long hours, he could often overhear his guards playing their favorite audio cassette over and over again. Its hateful propaganda called for the death of all Westerners.
Still, Father Jenko preferred this dismal solitude to attention. The guards in this prison were increasingly paranoid that Father Jenko had seen their faces, in spite of his blindfold.
In one instance, a guard woke up Father Jenko to give him a drink. As he sat up, startled, a clean tissue he had placed over his eye fell out of the blindfold. In the darkness, the guard thought he had taken off his blindfold to look at him. He brutally kicked Father Jenko as he lay on the closet floor.
Another time, Father Jenko was on his way to the bathroom when he recognized the same plastic spoon he was given at mealtimes lying in a pile of trash. Not wanting it to be thrown out, he picked it up and brought it back to his closet.
Later, the guards found the spoon. They were convinced that Father Jenko had hidden it to use it as a weapon, and as punishment, they hit him. They pounded his head so hard that he permanently lost 20% of his hearing.
The guards could even be cruel for no reason at all. One of their favorite games was to sit Father Jenko in the middle of the room and place their guns on his lap. They would ask him to read the inscriptions on the guns, which always said either "Made in Israel" or "The U.S." The men thought the irony of this was hilarious.
Other games were more brutal. On long afternoons, the guards would stand Father Jenko in the middle of the room and spin him in circles until he fell over. One day, he slammed into a wall so hard that his head began to bleed. Strangely, the sight of his injury seemed to disturb the guards, and they never spun him again.
All the while, Hezbollah leader Imad Mughniya, or Haj Radwan, refused to rest until the 17 prisoners in Kuwait were freed. And on March 16th, 2 months after Father Jenko's capture, they upped the ante. 37-year-old Terry Anderson, chief of the Associated Press in Beirut, was kidnapped following a morning game of tennis.
Father Jenko watched as the new prisoner was chained to a bed in the room outside his closet, but they were not allowed to talk. Father Jenko felt utterly alone.
Towards the end of April, the prisoners were transferred to a different apartment in the same building as before. This would be Father Jenko's fourth prison. He was chained to a wall in a hallway where he would remain until July. Through his blindfold, he could observe the other captives as they passed.
His old cubicle mate, CIA Station Chief William Buckley, would sometimes walk past on his way to the bathroom. He looked haggard and mentally unwell. He would exclaim nonsense to no one in particular. At one point, Father Jenko heard him ask for poached eggs.
Weeks passed and Buckley seemed to grow worse. Father Jenko could tell that he was dying.
Buckley had been a prisoner for 14 months. One way or another, he wouldn't stay captive much longer. And Father Jenko feared he may be the next to go.
Coming up, the Reagan administration makes a desperate bid to free the hostages in Lebanon. Now back to the story.
It was May 1985, and Father Lawrence Martin Jenko was still chained in the hallway of an apartment in South Beirut. He was one of several captives being held ransom in exchange for 17 Shia prisoners in Kuwait. Meanwhile, his captor, Haj Radwan, was plotting his next move.
On May 25th, a suicide driver from Hezbollah attempted to ram into the car of Kuwait's head of state, Sheikh Jaber. Although Jaber emerged from the accident with minor scratches and bruises, the insurgents took credit for the attack and sent a message demanding the release of their 17 cohorts.
3 days later, on May 28th, David Jacobson, the director of the American University Hospital in Beirut, was captured on his way to work. Less than 2 weeks later, on June 9th, Hezbollah kidnapped Thomas Sutherland, the Dean of Agriculture at the American University in Beirut. With 7 citizens now in captivity, the White House was growing desperate.
Meanwhile, Father Jenko's fellow hostage, CIA Chief William Buckley, was growing worse every week. Then, one day in early June, Father Jenko spied a pair of lifeless feet being dragged past him. He knew it was Buckley.
Following Buckley's death, Haj Radwan ordered the kidnapping of a Lebanese Jewish physician to examine and treat the surviving captives. The doctor prescribed diazide for Father Jenko's blood pressure and gave him an ointment for his eye infection.
And in spite of their callousness, the guards would occasionally surprise Father Jenko with other small, thoughtful gestures. One night, a guard was eating pizza and offered him a slice. Another guard offered him lemons whenever he had a stomach ache.
But the best gift of all was completely unexpected. One evening, the guards led him blindfolded up a flight of stairs. He walked through a doorway and realized he was on a rooftop. A refreshing sea breeze fanned his face. Then, one of the men removed his blindfold.
The panorama was breathtaking. The city of Beirut stretched out beneath him, glistening in the moonlight. It was one of the most beautiful experiences he'd had in his entire life. And because his blindfold had been removed, he was certain it would be his last.
Then one of the guards spoke. He explained simply, "Because the moon is so beautiful this evening, we wanted you to see it."
Meanwhile, in spite of their no negotiations policy, the White House was eventually forced to deal with the hostage situation in Lebanon. On June 14, 1985, Hezbollah insurgents, including Haj Radwan, hijacked TWA Flight 847 following its takeoff from Athens, Greece. 39 Americans would be held captive aboard the plane for the next 17 days. In exchange for their lives, the hijackers demanded freedom for 735 Shia prisoners in Israel, as well as the 17 jailed in Kuwait.
4 days later, President Reagan held a press meeting. He stressed that the U.S. was doing everything possible to secure the release of the 39 passengers while reaffirming that they would not make concessions to terrorist demands.
Well, the media focused their attention on the individual passengers, publishing biographies on each of the captives and interviewing their anxious families. The Jenkos were enraged. Father Jenko and the other six captives in Lebanon had never received this sort of attention, and they had been hostages for months. The Jenkos stormed the press, and overnight, the Forgotten Seven became major players in the national drama.
What followed was what Dr. Brigetta L. Nakos of Columbia University called a perfect case of individual versus national interest, exacerbated by the media. In these cases, the press responds to a terrorist crisis by highlighting the human aspects of the ordeal, but gives little focus to government rationale. In doing so, the general public is influenced to care more about the individuals at stake than the larger national interests.
This is what happened in the case of the TWA victims and the U.S. hostages in Lebanon. As the press linked both predicaments together, President Reagan had no choice but to follow suit. To separate the two would be perceived as cowardly and would damage his approval ratings.
Although his administration was not convinced that the hijackers and kidnappers were one and the same, at least their demands were unified. If the hijackers could somehow be appeased, perhaps both groups of hostages could be released.
Still, Reagan didn't want to appear to be conceding to terrorist demands. Over the next 2 weeks of the TWA crisis, the Reagan administration placed subtle pressure on their allies in Israel to release the 735 Shia prisoners. Delicate persuasion was attempted in Kuwait as well, but the Kuwaiti government wasn't about to free 17 Hezbollah cohorts after the recent assassination attempt on their leader.
In the meantime, President Reagan assured Americans that measures were being taken to release all 46 prisoners. It was a grandiose statement, but he hoped it would prove true.
As the days dragged on, Reagan traveled to Chicago, where he not only met with families of the TWA passengers, but for the first time, granted an audience to Father Jenko's family. It gave the Jenkos hope that their brother would be released.
But this optimism would be short-lived. On June 30th, the last passengers were released from TWA Flight 847. 4 days later, Israel freed 300 Shia prisoners, though they insisted that the incidents were not connected. The Forgotten Seven, however, remained in captivity.
To the public, President Reagan had partially succeeded, and freeing the hostages in Lebanon was now at the top of his agenda.
As the Reagan administration prepared to switch tactics, Father Jenko was experiencing a welcome change of his own. It was early July 1985, 7 months into his captivity, when his captors brought him to his fifth prison, an apartment on top of a school building in Beirut. And for the first time, he had roommates.
At first, it was just Ben Weir, but 2 weeks later, Tom Sutherland joined them. And on August 14th, all three men were moved into the basement beneath the school, where they were joined by the remaining U.S. hostages, Terry Anderson and David Jacobson.
Another American hostage, 62-year-old librarian Peter Kilburn, had been executed in April. With Peter and William Buckley's deaths, the Forgotten Seven were actually the Forgotten Five.
This new living arrangement was a vast improvement for Father Jenko. The five men kept each other company and invented ways to pass the time. They made a deck of cards and a chessboard out of magazine scraps and played word games like 20 questions. Father Jenko and Ben Weir led Bible studies. They called themselves the Church of the Locked Door.
Although they had initially instructed the captives not to talk to each other, the guards didn't seem to mind this camaraderie at all. In fact, their conditions generally seemed to improve dramatically in this prison.
One guard Father Jenko had an affinity for was named Fadl. He had a persistent kind streak, and whenever he was on morning duty, he brought Turkish coffee to the captives. As Father Jenko received his cup, he purposely looked the guard in the eye and said, "Thank you, Fadl. I really appreciate this."
Dr. Jeff Thompson of New York University and Lipscomb University calls this stroking. Crisis negotiators employ this technique by complimenting their subject on a positive action. The key to stroking is to frame the positive action as an individual choice the person made, not something they were told to do.
Father Jenko knowingly employed stroking when he thanked Fadl by name each morning. It was a form of positive reinforcement that made his captivity bearable.
The remaining 11 months of Father Jenko's confinement were spent in this slightly better routine. With five men in one room, he was cramped, but far less lonely than before.
Back in America, the White House was enmeshed in a secret plan to release the forgotten captives. Refusing to negotiate hadn't gotten them anywhere, and the Kuwait government was no help either. In the summer of 1985, the Reagan administration would begin a new strategy, the second phase of a top-secret foreign policy subterfuge. It would come to be known as the Iran-Contra affair.
The Contras were a group of rebels in Nicaragua who were fighting to overthrow their new communist government. The group had been organized and funded by the CIA. Not wanting to be entangled in the mess any longer, Congress had issued a directive to stop all military aid to Nicaragua. But rather than obey orders, Reagan's administration secretly collaborated with the CIA to find new ways to keep funding the Contras.
U.S. intelligence knew that Iran held significant influence over Shia militant factions in Lebanon. Iran was also engaged in a war against Iraq, and they desperately needed weapons. Taking all of these factors into consideration, White House officials devised a plan to kill two birds with one stone. They would sell arms to Iran, take the money, and funnel it directly to the Contras. As part of the bargain, they asked Iran to pressure Hezbollah into releasing their American hostages.
On September 14, 1985, 408 U.S. missiles were delivered to Iran. The very next day, Reverend Ben Weir was released in Beirut. It was a start.
But it was only a start. January 7th, 1986, marked 1 year of captivity for Father Jenko. The Reagan administration was still actively selling arms to Iran, but by the time spring arrived, no more progress had been made.
Fortunately, another country in the Middle East was becoming involved. Hoping to improve their relations with the U.S., Syria turned a sympathetic ear to the hostage situation. Over the next few months, they would use their alliance with Iran to gain more information about the whereabouts of Shia militant groups in Lebanon. By early June 1986, Syrian leaders had deduced that the remaining U.S. captives were being held in Beirut. And by the end of the month, they were deploying troops into the city to find them.
They hoped this military presence would squeeze Hezbollah into releasing more hostages, and in a sense, they were right. On July 26, 1986, Haj Radwan visited the four remaining captives. He told them that they were being moved. One by one, each captive was led out of the room they shared until only Father Jenko was left.
When Radwan told him to sit down, Father Jenko feared the worst. He asked if he was going to be killed. Radwan said, "No, Abuna, you are going home."
Overcome by relief, Father Jenko began to cry. Radwan silently brought a letter out of his pocket and began to read it. Father Jenko recognized the words. He had written them himself in a letter to his family on Christmas.
In the letter, he had written a Bible verse about forgiveness and told his family not to hate his captors. Haj Radwan had never sent the letter, and now he was using it to ask Father Jenko to forgive him.
As the guards came into the room to retrieve him, one of them pressed a small cross into his hands. His old crucifix had been taken away from him on the day he was captured. It was like they were giving it back, along with his life.
Father Jenko was still stunned as the guards brought him blindfolded into the elevator. One of them rubbed his shoulders with compassion as they led him to a car.
After several hours, the car came to a stop at the edge of an empty road. The guards handed Father Jenko 5 Lebanese pounds and pointed him to the left before driving into the night. He would later learn that he had been dropped on the outskirts of eastern Lebanon.
Father Jenko began to walk, and gradually, a town and lake appeared in the distance. When he reached the village, Father Jenko made his way to the police station.
Within minutes, a group of Syrian soldiers came to retrieve him. They brought him to Damascus, where he was held in a government building until the American ambassador to Syria arrived. He was finally going home.
The hostage situation in Lebanon continued for years following Father Jenko's release. The last of the Forgotten Seven, Terry Anderson, wasn't released until 1991.
Haj Radwan's cousin Mustafa would escape his captivity in Kuwait in 1990. Together, the two would continue on as top officials in Hezbollah for the next 2 decades. Haj Radwan was assassinated by a car bomb in 2008. He died before most people ever learned that his real name was Imad Mughniyeh.
Following his release, Father Jenko spent time with his extended family in Joliet, Illinois. He would later become the campus minister at the University of Southern California, and then an associate pastor at St. Domitilla's Church in Hillside, Illinois. He passed away in 1996, 1 week before the 10th anniversary of his release. He is still remembered by the family and friends who never once forgot him.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. For more information on Father Lawrence Martin Jenko, amongst the many sources we used, we found his biography, Bound to Forgive, extremely helpful to our research. We will be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Well, not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Hostage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Hostage was written by Ali Wicker, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.